there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Shouldn't you be at home?
Yeboah, on he goes! Oh! And Grobbelaar had to be alert. Steve Sedgley gets the goal! Torsford saved a penalty here on Wednesday, and he saves another one! Delightful ball again by Barnes. McMahon in for Beardsley!
Penrice with the throw. Headed on by Devon White. Peacock's there, and Peacock with a magnificent goal.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Only Hatton.
No.
Hello, and welcome to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? And welcome to... Now, that's what I call Quickly Kevin Lockdown Specials. My name is Chris Gold. Joining me, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And the man who has hoarded the Sabutio 1970 Brazil team is Michael Mard.
Hello.
How are you all feeling?
All right.
Yeah, it's a tricky time.
Just to be clear, all of these are recorded, until we say otherwise, have all been recorded in one go.
Yeah.
On the Thursday before the first episode of this series was put out.
Yes.
So please don't inform the authorities.
In fact, are they all scheduled to go out? So if there is the apocalypse and we all die, the new episodes of Quickly Kevin will still be coming out, which I was sure our relatives will very much enjoy. We'll be like Tupac, releasing albums long after we're gone. Yeah.
I've got a little treat for us, because I thought, who's the most rousing national treasure you could think of? Churchill.
Yeah.
Blair.
Nelson.
Theresa May. No. Des Lynam.
Oh, yes.
So what, we've not covered this before. Are you aware of Time to Stand and Stare, Des Lynam's poetry and music album?
I'm aware of its existence because of the reading of If, the famous reading of If.
Yeah, so that gave him the idea to do this.
Right.
They did If at the end of France 98, just apropos of nothing, yeah. And then it was such a success that he then released an album with 23 different poems on, including If. But most excitingly of all, number 12 is called The Scilly Isles, spelled S-I-L-L-Y.
Bit of a bonus.
Yeah, by D.M. Lynam.
Oh.
We won't do that one today, but I thought we'd end each with a poem by Des Lynam.
Lovely.
But what we'll be doing in these episodes, we are going to be playing you some of our best bits from all of our previous episodes, and also we're going to be getting through correspondence that is brilliant that we haven't had a chance to read, because there's so much good stuff that's come in from our listeners. So... shall we start with the electronic postbag?
You've got mail.
Dear Josh, Chris and Michael, whilst on a morning jog listening to the Darren Huckabee episode, I was delighted to hear his account of a man I have played under at both Cambridge United and Histon.
Oh, wow.
This is from M, so we don't know.
Okay.
I feel duty-bound to inform Quickly Kevin listeners that Mr. Beck was an outstanding coach and gets a raw deal, particularly from 90s football players and fans alike. However, I remember him in training describing a perfectly executed long throw routine as wanking material. So in short, I'm not sure what to think. Out of a healthy dose of fear and respect, I wish to remain anonymous. M. Ooh. Wanking material. Do you think you'd get that with Pep Guardiola?
Do you think any elite manager practices throw-ins now?
Yeah, Liverpool have got a throw-in coach.
Really?
Because there was all this kind of...
Steve Nicol went absolutely batshit on, I think, possibly ESPN. He was so irate that they had a throw-in coach.
Why not? I mean, surely John Beck would be the ultimate throw-in coach. His managerial philosophy was throw-ins. Why isn't he out? Why is he out the game? Madness.
That scene where John Beck got hired by, say, Pep Guardiola to be the throw-in coach would be like, you know, a sort of grizzled old war veteran that comes out of retirement. in an action movie, he's the only person that can save the day.
I'd love to see a film where Liverpool win the league off the back of a throw-in. That story, like a Mickey-style, like Rocky box, like he's the coach.
Do you think Pep Guardiola and John Beck, it would be like one of those odd couple cop movies where they're two guys who've got completely different ideas that come together?
John Beck going, I'm getting too old for this shit.
You're friends with Rufus Brevitt, aren't you?
Yeah.
You got his number?
Yeah.
Hi, lads. I was working at Toys R Us, the big one in Woking. And one evening, in the run-up to Christmas, I had the delight of serving former QPR and Fulham defender Rufus Brevitt. He had chosen to buy a battery-powered ride-on Jeep for his kids. After arranging delivery and getting the paperwork signed, I obviously shoved the freshly inked paper into my pocket. There's no way I was losing this piece of memorabilia. Unfortunately, I forgot to duplicate it, and the poor Brevitt kids never got their battery-powered Jeep in time for Christmas.
Oh, no.
What a terrible person I was. The week after Christmas, the unnecessarily understanding player returned to the shop, at which point I realised my lack of judgment. But, instead of berating me, coolly arranged a delivery, to which I ended the conversation with a harrowing statement, I'm very sorry, Rufus Brevitt. Something that still haunts me to this day. Dan Oswin from Oak.
Oh, Woking. Man. Rufus. I mean, he's a really nice guy, so I understand that. Have I told you the story? I can't. In our early days, we got an email from, or maybe it was a Facebook message or something, that said that they had once seen on the Coventry Uni, the Coventry University were doing some sort of protest, and there was a bit of kind of reaction from the people who were local to Coventry against this protest, like calling them lazy students. And Rufus Brevitt had popped up on this notice board saying, "You lazy students need to get a job."
Oh, no.
This is the claim.
Oh, no.
I asked him about it and he denies it. But I like to think Rufus Brevitt considers all students lazy. But I'll ask him about that.
Yeah, if you could ask him about that, that would be ideal. This is from Michael Hand. Hi, guys. Love the show. Growing up in Cromswell, Manchester in the 90s, me and my friends were staunch Manchester United fans. It came to our surprise when, knocking on for my mate to play football on the street, he came out in a Chelsea shirt. When we had all laughed and asked what he was doing, he replied, "My mum had seen it in a sports shop and thought that CFC on the badge stood for Cromswell Football Club." He was then forced to wear it for the next couple of the weeks every time he came out to play football until it mysteriously went missing. Bit of fun, isn't it?
That's kind of sweet.
There's actually, I think there's a rich vein there of like your parents buying you the wrong football kit.
Yeah.
There's stories definitely in West Ham, but maybe just the generation before mine, but it was like buying the Scunthorpe kit instead of West Ham because you just thought it was the colours.
Oh.
Anything on that, parents making a footballing mistake.
Yes, if your mum's bought you the wrong item or the wrong shirt or any of that, or your dad. After all, it's the 90s. This is how you get in touch.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list @quicklykevin.com.
So it's time now for the best bits of our previous series in a feature we're calling Now That's What I Call Quickly Kevin. And first up, it's the 90s legend and the first ever guest on the show, Matt Letizier, to tell us all about the legend of Ali Dyer.
The title of this episode is going to be The Best and Worst Premiership Player. And you're obviously the best.
The worst. I fully believe that.
The worst, consistently voted the worst, Ali Dyer. Now, the two of you crossed the touchline together. Your careers almost intertwined.
Yeah. Let's go back to the start of Ali Dyer.
Start.
If you're listening and you don't know who Ali Dyer is, then you shouldn't be listening, really.
You know nothing about 90s football.
Yeah, this isn't the point. How have you got this far into the podcast? Surely you should have turned off at the discussion of the Dales stand. So, Ali Dyer. When was the first time you heard about Ali Dyer?
When he turned up for training before we played against Leeds at home on the Saturday. We had a rumour that this guy was George Weah's cousin, and that George had rang up Graham Souness and said, "You should take a look at my cousin, he's a really good player." And this guy turned up in training.
Did you talk to him?
I don't recall talking to him.
Didn't? Did anyone ask him about George Weah?
I don't believe so. His English wasn't that good, actually.
Oh, was it not?
No.
I bet it was. That was part of the lie.
It probably was, yeah. It probably was perfect.
I mean, the lies he told, I think the language is a small one.
So he turned up at training.
He turned up at training, and I can remember thinking, watching him training, going, what's this bloke doing? Like, I honestly thought he'd won a competition. Like, to come train with us in the local paper. And he turned on this.
That must have happened quite a lot at Southampton.
We had a few. But it was strange. It was like, he wasn't very good.
So in training, so what kind of things are you doing on a day like that?
So we were playing, I remember the Friday before the game, it was always pretty relaxed on the Friday. We did a little warm-up, then we'd have a little game of five-a-side. You know, it wasn't anything too strenuous, but even in the five-a-side, he was looking at him going, ooh. Okay. And then, so that was on the Friday, and then we turn up on the Saturday at the Dell, and we sat in the change room about half past one, 3 o'clock kickoff, and he's in there. We're all thinking,
what is
that? Was a good competition. He gets to come and listen to the team talk and everything.
When he turned up for training, did he know what to do? Was it like, was he know, oh, here are the boots? Did he bring his own boots? Like,
That's a good. No, he would have been given. He would have been given his own kit. But he would have had to have brought his own boots. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. As a trialist, you don't get given. You don't get given boots. But he would have been all kitted up properly.
Did he look nervous?
Yes. Yeah, he did look a little bit. And maybe, yeah, maybe his performance was down to nerves. Maybe he was actually a really good player.
Yeah.
He just got a little bit tense.
Would you get that with players that would turn up on their first day in training and be rubbish?
You could see the ones that were really nervous to be there. And it does make a difference.
So when you're in the dressing room, were you thinking there's a chance he's going to be good?
Not really. It was quite odd, because I remember the team being named, and then Graham Souness going, and the subs are so-and-so and Ali Dia. I'm like, really? Jeez.
And was there only two subs in those days?
I think it was two or maybe three tops. So there might have been two and a goalkeeper.
Yeah.
I think it might have been in those days. And then, sure enough, 20 minutes into the game, I get a thigh strain. And I can't continue in the game, and I was like, I got to come off, and I looked up, and he stood on the touchline. I'm thinking, no. And so forever.
Was part of you excited to see him play?
Not really. No, obviously, we wanted to win the game. Yeah. I mean, win bonuses were like quite good in those days, in comparison to what we were earning as a weekly wage. So I wasn't best pleased to see him come on. And forevermore now, when the name of Ali Dia gets mentioned as the worst player ever to play in the Premier League, I have to sit there and go, yeah, and he came on.
How bad is bad? Like, is he like a League Two player? Well, or like, could we have got away with it for as long?
Yeah.
Possibly.
Really?
He was just a bloke off the street.
He went from us, he then went, I think, to play at Gateshead.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's dropped from Premier League quite a few divisions in one hit. And even then, I'm not sure he was that great for Gateshead.
He's on the subs bench for then.
I've been obsessed with the question. I've argued this with my friend Tom, right? He believes that if you played up front for a season for a Premier League team, 90 minutes a week, you would score one goal by the law of averages.
Ooh, I don't know about that. I don't know. You've got to be half decent to actually get a goal.
Do you not think the ball bobbling around from a corner? That's a shake of the head.
Put your body in there.
Oh, I'm not sure.
If it's in the mixer long enough.
I'm not sure. If you're really bad, I'm not sure you get even one. I mean, it's quite a tough place to score goals, you know. I might have made it look easy, but it wasn't that.
Just on Ali Dyer, so like my uni mate Mark, he maintains that he was there that day when Ali Dyer played, and he said he wasn't that bad. Like he maintains that it was like some misunderstanding. I mean, what did he look like? I think you're on record saying Bambi on ice. But like, what was he doing?
Headless chicken kind of sprang to mind a little bit as well.
Did he have positional sense?
He had not great positional sense. And I can remember, though, he did have a really good chance to score. I think
he
very nearly scored, yeah. The ball got flashed across the front of goal and he went flying in, and I think he missed the ball completely. But
he got subbed off, didn't he, as well?
He did, yeah. So he came on after 20 minutes for me, and I think he went off again on about, I think it was about 65, 70 minutes or something.
Yeah. He came off for Ken Moncow, and we were saying, was that a positional change? You know, did Souness think, actually, you know, you've done your job, Ali?
Yeah, I think Souness probably thought at this point, Ken Moncow is a better centre-forward than Ali, even though he spent his career at centre-back.
So let's talk about the fallout after the game. You get in the dressing room. I presume Ali sat there, head in his hands. What happens? Is he sheepish about what he's done?
I'd be terrified if I was him at this point.
Yeah. All I can remember is that I remember speaking to the physio on Monday morning, and apparently Ali Dia had reported in on the Sunday after the game to the physio for some treatment.
That's unbelievable.
I don't know if he was trying to claim that he got subbed because he was injured, because he was just rubbish.
Unbelievable bottle.
So he turned up on the Sunday, had some treatment with the physio on the Sunday morning, and then decided that he'd had enough, and he left, and he just went.
Wow.
Left the hotel that he was staying at. He just did a run of that.
It.
Left the hotel bill unpaid.
Did he know the game was up? Was he scared of Souness? Like scared of Souness?
I don't know if he thought
somebody
might have rumbled what was going on, and he's just done he's done one.
So on the Monday morning, do you guys come in and go,
where is it?
Where is it?
Where's our star?
That's how I found, because I went into the physio. I went, where's the lad that played on Saturday?
He went, the fact he still didn't know his name.
Done a runner. Yeah.
Lad,
I
know. Lad that played on
Saturday. It was a very, very odd turn of events.
Or did Souness ever say to the team, I'll admit that?
I don't, yeah. Do you know what? The strange thing about it all is that I've seen Graham quite a few times since, and I've never been brave enough to ask him. I think he'd just rip my head off if I start ripping the mick out of him.
I mean, the thing about it is, no due diligence. He just put him straight in.
None whatsoever.
Yeah. I kind of admire it as a move.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. The front to do that.
No.
I mean, how would you even invent that?
It was always like,
sat there in a pub and go, I bet you can't play in the Premier League with his mates.
Yeah,
you go, right, I'll take that bet on. How am I going to do this?
Yeah.
I know.
Did they ever find out who made the call pretending to be George Weah?
I heard it was his cut, like, a friend of his.
George Weah?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure their paths would have crossed.
No.
Yeah.
I love the idea that George Weah would have thought, I'm going to call Graham Souness of all people.
I know. He's looking for his contact book. Yeah. Comes across Souness. Here we go.
Which club are going to be gullible enough to fall for this?
Next up is Arsenal and Middlesbrough legend Paul Merson to talk us through the arrival of Arsene Wenger and the time he moved to Middlesbrough with his brother.
So, like, the Premier League era really changes when Arsene Wenger comes in.
Yeah.
Right? But he comes in, surely, I mean, you've got Adams, you've got Parley yourself, right? These English lads are still with that kind of 80s mentality of going out. Was it a shock to him to see you?
He changed the face of football, the whole face.
Yeah.
In my opinion. Oh, he come in, you'd have thought he was Clouseau.
Really?
Honestly, it was unbelievable. You thought, oh, no, this ain't working. You know, he'd go to a hotel and go, can I have a room? He'd be like, he literally was like Inspector Clouseau. Ray used to call him Clouseau. He used to call him it. But he was brilliant. I couldn't talk highly enough of him. He was so far ahead of his
time.
How
quickly did you realise that he was good?
A week.
Really?
No, see, we were doing these exercises we used to do warm-up. We went away with England and we'd be doing them exercises, the lads, and all the England lads would be doing them. They'd be joining in. Yeah. Doing them like that they'd never ever seen before, that no one was doing, and that everybody started doing it.
Was there a moment where, like, Wenger, like, it changed? You realised, like, oh, you couldn't be, like, eating whatever you want? Was there, like,
I mean, straight away he took the beer out of the players' lounge. So he knocked that on the head. No drinking after the game.
Really?
Yeah.
So what did you do?
Not go up there. But it was so far ahead, and all the lads were getting in early for work. Like November the 8th, you'd be training at Arsenal, and I could tell you what we're doing on March the 7th with Jules Graham. 5 months later, I could tell you exactly what we're doing. You know, but it worked, and we won things. But he come in, and people were flying into training at 9 o'clock in the morning. It was that good to train.
Really?
It was all 15 minutes. All 15 minute stuff, so you don't lose concentration and all that. But like you do 8v8, which is a thing you used to do, like 8v8 games. Usually managers just say go and play. But his was all one. If you take two touch, your second touch has got to go forward, and you always had to think about it. It was never just go out and play.
Yeah,
it was honestly, it was brilliant.
What was his man management like with you?
It was all right. Was I got on really well with him. I played every game under him, bar when I had a hernia. Yeah. I'd got offered a new contract at Arsenal. People think that I was thrown out. I got offered a 4-year contract at Arsenal.
So why did you go to Middlesbrough?
Because they doubled my wages.
Pretty simple.
I remember saying to him after, when I went up there to see Brian Robson, and I come back and he said, what happened? I said, well, I've signed a 4-year contract. And he asked me what I got, and he said that we're not even giving Dennis Bergkamp that.
Really?
I was getting more than Dennis Bergkamp, and I was playing in the Championship.
That's
and he
mad.
Was the greatest player ever.
Yeah.
God, that's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been a culture change again. Like, go to Middlesbrough.
But
I imagine you'd lived in London your whole life at that point.
Yeah, I had, but I didn't move up for ages. I drove up every day for the first 2 months.
Gee, that's
every day.
What's that?
What?
Four and a half, five hours?
I left my house at 5 in the morning.
What?
In St Albans. And I drove to Darlington where we trained, and I drove back home every day.
Oh, my word.
Every day. I scored one goal in my first 7 games away at Stockport County in the league. One goal. And then they said, you're not driving anymore. So I used to have to get the train up every morning. So I used to drive to Stevenage from St Albans, get on the 7:47 train. There'd be a car waiting for me to take to the training ground, which I was late every day. So instead of fining me, the lads, I said I'd just pay for the whole Christmas due. And then I had to be back on the 201, even if train hadn't finished.
Did you move in the end?
And then I moved up.
Did you not know where Middlesbrough was when you signed?
No, because my wife didn't come at the time. That's what it was. She said, I'm not moving. The kids are staying at school. I thought she was joking when she said that. I thought she was joking. And I thought, when I sign and I tell her how much I'm getting, do you know what I mean? She'll move. But she didn't move. She probably thought, I'll get half of that anyway. So, I don't have to move.
Because there was a rumour that they, when they brought foreign players over to sign for Middlesbrough, they'd show them around London.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I moved to Ravenelli's house in the end. They had a 6-bedroom clubhouse.
Oh, yeah.
And they got my brother to move up with me to keep me company.
Yeah.
And they put him on £400 a week, my brother.
Really?
What, sit and watch telly with me.
That's a nice job, isn't
it? He was fucking devastated when I left. Seriously, he was devastated. But that was his job, to sit and watch telly with me. I liked it up there. People say I left there because of, but I liked it. It was a good place. Good people. Really good people.
Well, speaking of good people, you said Brian Robson was one of the reasons that you
definitely.
Joined. Have you seen this picture of him when he's announced as player manager? There's this picture, this infamous picture. Can you just describe what you're
looking at? What is he doing?
Can you just describe to the listeners what you're looking at there, this picture?
I am looking at Brian Robson on the pitch with no boots, with football socks, with his foot on a ball, with shorts on, then his tie, his jacket, and holding a scarf up. And I just thinking, why are you holding the scarf? Really?
That's mad, isn't it? A player manager, they've taken that so literally, the photograph.
Surely, I mean, the other way.
When you sign, you always get the lean up against the post, hold the ball, keep it up, hold the flag. But I've never seen that. That is unbelievable.
When you sign for a team as well, how soon do they do the picture afterwards? You sign the contract and then they go, right, come upstairs, put in the shirt, there you go.
I went Middlesbrough because it was the biggest transfer.
Yeah.
And it only got broke about 3 or 4 years ago. So it was the highest, most expensive player ever to get transferred to a Championship club. So when I went, you had every single examination in the world. It took forever. AIDS test, everything. You had the lot done. So you had to wait for everything to come back and then the pictures come out. Because they don't want to give you the pictures and then there's something wrong with you, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I left the year after. I went to Aston Villa for £6.75 million. My exam, at Middlesbrough, you've got to remember I was having MRIs, tests, exams, everything. When I went to Aston Villa, the doctor laid me on the bench. He hit my knee with a thing a couple of times. They looked in the Rothmans book and they went, he's played 500 games now. He played 49 games last season. That'll do. And that was it.
Wow.
And that was my thing, 6.75 million.
There was one story Letitia told us when we interviewed him, that you lived with Paul Gascoigne
when
you went to Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
And the way you'd kill time...
It's drink red wine and take sleeping tablets.
And you put money in the middle.
Put money in the middle. Whenever I fell asleep last, just picked the money up off the table and went to bed. And you'd be sitting there and you go, you look around and you go, and as you went to take the money, someone would go, I'm not asleep yet. Got another tablet to take. Me, my brother and Gazza and Jimmy.
So your brother was doing his job then?
Oh, yeah. He made sure I got a bed.
And finally this episode, it's a delightful Jim Rosenthal discussing the origin of the name of our show. And after that, the story of how future leader of the free world Donald Trump came to host the Rumbelows Cup draw.
So this podcast is called Quickly Kevin Willie Score.
Right.
That's an infamous bit of Brian Moore commentary.
Oh, is it?
Are you familiar with it?
Now I exactly know where you're coming from, and I know if it makes you guys feel any better that you think you thought of a wonderful title. Brian was desperately, desperately upset about saying that and putting Kevin Keegan on the spot. And if there's one line that the best commentator in my mind in the business regretted saying, it was
Jim.
Quickly Kevin will he score.
Oh no,
so that has absolutely rolled a hand grenade.
Let's see what we're called next week.
Yes.
We've bought the domain now. We're tied in.
So was Kevin upset by it, or did he not?
Well, I think they both were, really. And then, one of the pitfalls of being a commentator is that your brain thinks something and it doesn't get filtered, and it comes out. And poor Kevin, he's sitting there. What's he supposed to say? No, he's murder. No, can't hit a barn door from 12 yards. You know, of course he won't score. But I know Brian, almost every time I think he saw him subsequently, he apologised. You can either say putting him on the spot, which probably would be the right thing. I would prefer to say throwing him under the bus. If I'm honest.
So you worked on Saint and Greaves.
I did. For many years.
You were involved, maybe not in front of the camera, on the Donald Trump draw.
Yes, yeah.
How did this come about? So for people that haven't listened to
I will tell you this. This is just my version of it.
Yeah, lovely.
In that we found ourselves in freezing New York before the World Cup draw for USA 94, which happened in December 93.
Yeah.
And Saint and Greaves were over there. And then from England came the goal, from London came, crikey, do you realise we've got to do the draw for the Rumbelows Cup, which everybody had forgotten. And so you picture yourself, you're in New York, and we think, crikey, how are we going to do this? And I actually said, do you know what? I've got a number for Robert De Niro. They went, give him a try. So then I ring his people, etc., etc. And when the word comes back, Bobby would love to have done it, but Bobby's otherwise engaged.
I bet.
So then someone's looking up and we go, well, what about him, Donald Trump? And then Donald Trump is rung up, and obviously a man who's never afraid of coming in front of a TV camera at any stage, even though he knew nothing about anything, not a lot has changed. And that's how it happened. Wow. And Donald Trump and the Saint and Greaves, the legendary draw for the Rumbelows. For the Rumbelows Cup.
It's amazing. Have you watched it recently?
I have watched it.
There's an amazing bit where Jimmy Greaves makes a joke about, I've not been in a boardroom this big since Doug Ellis.
And Donald Trump laughs. There's no way he can know the reference.
Jimmy Greaves, who will draw the home team, and Donald Trump, who will draw the away team.
Donald, very pleased to meet you,
nice
sir.
Nice meeting you.
Well done, Donald. Thank you.
This is some pad you've got here, isn't it?
No, it's pretty good. I hope you enjoy it. I like it.
This is beautiful. I'll tell you what, I haven't seen a ballroom like this since I was in Doug Ellis's at Aston Villa. But we'll go
carry on. Yeah, carry on with the drop.
But listen, I think he was quite a good sport, if I'm honest. Yeah. And then he took part in it, and he did it. He didn't have a clue if he was from Leeds or Manchester United. Not a clue, but it all worked. And Rumbelows were very, very grateful. They should be now, by the way.
They're still going. That is the best sponsorship money they've ever spent.
On the subject of draws, FA Cup draws,
yes.
How tedious do you find them?
I had quite a few years doing that.
Yeah.
And the first one that I did, It was certainly anything but tedious because it was round the corner in Soho Square, and the worst draw is the draw for the first round proper because you have whatever it is, 86, 92, I mean, massive, never stop. And Ozzy Ardiles, they gave me Ozzy Ardiles as the first guy to do it. And so we do the rehearsal, and we just do a little rehearsal here, Ozzy. And I think Ray Clements was doing the away team or whatever. So Ray said, number one, Accrington Stanley will play. And Ozzy went, number two,
And in my ears, people going, what the? What did he say? What did he say?
So we go again, and Clem goes in, and number 19, Burnley, where we'll play Aussie. And I thought, this is the first one I've done. This is a complete and utter stitch up. This. And so I went. I said, Aussie, I'm not meaning to be rude here, mate. You're going to have to really enunciate, really, because if you don't say the number properly, we don't know which. And you're, okay, Jim. Okay. So we get to do the real thing.
Is it live?
And it was live.
Oh, yeah, of course it's live.
Well, the real thing. And then, all right, you know, number 14, Exeter City, will play. And Ozzy goes, number 61. At that pace. And the draw overran. And then they went, can you speed him up? And they went, no.
Thank you so much for listening. They've all been a pleasure to make these episodes, so it's lovely to hear them again. Before we go, talking of lovely to hear again, let's leave you with a man to take you through these trying times. It's Des Lynam from his album Poems and Music, Time to Stand and Stare. What number do you want, Skull? So, from 2 to 22. I'm not a knowledge on poetry. I know that number 5 is Stop All the Clocks by W.H. Auden, which, of course, I know. It was written for Four Weddings and a Funeral, and I don't feel like that's appropriate. Go for it.
7
Sussex by Rudyard Kipling. And before you listen, it is more fun if you imagine that all instruments are played by Steve Ryder. This is Desmond Lynam.
God gave all men all earth to love, but since our hearts are small, ordained for each one spot should prove beloved over all. That, as he watched creation's birth, so we, in godlike mood, may of our love create our earth and see that it is good. So one shall Baltic pines content, as one some Surrey glade, or one the palm grove's droned lament before Levuka's trade. Each to his choice, and I rejoice the lot has fallen to me. In a fair ground, yea, Sussex by the sea. Here leaps ashore the full sou'west, all heavy-winged with brine. Here lies above the folded crest the channel's leaden line. And here the sea-fogs lap and cling, and here, each warning each, the sheep-bells and the ship-bells ring along the hidden beach. Here through the strong and shadeless days the tinkling silence thrills, or little lost down churches praise the Lord who made the hills. But here the old gods guard their round, and in her secret heart the heathen kingdom Wilfred found dreams as she dwells apart. Though all the rest were all my share, with equal soul I'd see her 39 sisters fair, yet none more fair than she. Choose ye your need from Thames to Tweed, and I will choose instead such lands as lie twixt Rake and Rye, Black Down and Beachy Head. God gives all men all earth to love, but since man's heart is small, ordains for each one spot shall prove beloved over all. Each to his choice, and I rejoice the lot has fallen to me. In a fair ground, yea, Sussex by the sea.